up to Perek Daled, chapter 4, and the first of the speeches by Job's friends, acquaintances, comforters perhaps, or not. Remember that last week, Job cracked. In the sense that after his friends were silent for a week of sitting there, they're unable to offer comfort. After his wife had told him that it's time to give up, essentially, different ways to take what she said, but that seems to be the thrust of it. Job curses the day he was born, and we talked about different ways to understand what he was trying to accomplish. Was that simply a lament for his state? Was he trying to turn to God and actually say, I wish you would reverse my birth? Was he making a statement regarding night and day in general and the universe in general and saying that he wants everything to fall apart? He cannot make sense of what is happening in this world. We gave all sorts of different explanations for what was happening in Perek Gimel in chapter 3. That brings us to chapter 4 and the first response to Eov, the first response to Job. Now, one of the problems that we're going to run into is that we are going to see three of these acquaintances speak: Eliphaz, Bildad, and Sophar. And they are different in name, but it can be very hard to distinguish the difference in content. Part of the difficulty is because of their language. They use dense language with hard words, with a lot of poetry mixed in, so that it's hard enough to figure out what one is saying, let alone what the difference is between what 1, 2, and 3 are saying. That's one of the challenges. Another challenge, though, is that there's overlap. They actually share language and they share imagery, so that it becomes difficult to remember who said what. A third problem is the fact that, in truth, they share each other's arguments. They're not only sharing language. There are times when one of them will say something to Job, and you'll say, oh, wait, didn't someone else just say that? And the answer is yes. So it's hard to discern what's going on. But, nonetheless, we do think that there is something going on with three different speakers, that in fact there are three different voices intended. If you take a look at source number 1 on your sheet, you'll see what Malbim had to say about this problem in his introduction to the book of Eov of Job. Take a look at source number 1, please. He said, V'yadua, okay, it is known, Shasefer hamechubar bederach vikuach, that a book that is composed in a manner of vikuach, or as he puts it in parentheses, dialogue. Okay? If you have a book that is composed in the manner of debate and discussion, bo yidabru anashim shonim, in which different people speak, v'yitvakhu ish es achiv, and one debates with his brother, yiya mispar hadayot kefi mispar hamitvakhim. He says the number of views being expressed will match the number of speakers. Shekol achad min hamitvakhim yesh lo de'a v'sha'a miyuchedet sh'apia ya'aroch advikuchau, such that each of the speakers, each of the participants, is going to have his own idea and his own appointed time in which he will speak and present his view. Because if all you had were two views, if you only had two views, then the author of the book would make it a lot simpler, right? You'd have one person speaking and the other one responding, and that would be that. Indeed, there is a work, an ancient Near Eastern work called the Babylonian Theodicy, in which there is a speaker who is trying to comfort someone who is suffering. It's not like Eov, where we have three people and eventually a fourth speaking to him. So Malbim says it can't be that all three of these people are expressing the same idea. If that were true, then you wouldn't have three different actors. That's the assumption that he makes. V'chein ishtadil haRambam b'more v'acharav kol yishrei leiv li'acheis l'chol achad ben harayim de'am yuchedet. And so, he says, the Rambam, among others, has indeed tried to show how, in fact, each of the speakers represents a different point of view. So Malbim's first point, which you have to remember, is that he believes that Eliphaz, Sofar, Bildad are each going to express a unique perspective. Despite the difficulties that I outlined a couple of minutes ago, that's what Malbim says. And so he continues in his second paragraph. We're still in source number one. Ulam, however, bivoam im ha-sefer, when they actually come to the book, and by the way, if you're familiar with Tanakh, you know Malbim is channeling different verses in different places. So if you see something that doesn't quite fit what you expect in terms of grammar, don't get thrown off. Odds are it's because he's quoting a pasuk. So for example, bivoam im ha-sefer is borrowed from a phrase in Megillat Esther. But the Masefer isn't really the way it should read. It should read Bevoam El HaSefer. But again, that's what he's doing. In any case, he says, when they actually get to the book, these people who want to show that each of the three speakers has a different perspective, when they arrive at the book itself, to try to explain and clarify its words in this manner, that each one is presenting a different point of view, all these mighty people suddenly can't find their hands. Meaning that they lose their ability, they lose their capacity. There's a familiar phrase, arov kaved, from the Makos in the plagues in Egypt. Because he says, with just a little examination, you discover a heavy arov, destroying the entire arrangement of the book. Arov is the fourth of the ten plagues. It is translated in one of two ways, either as wild animals or as moraine, which is some kind of a plague. But arov at its core comes from the term, irbuvia. Irbuvia, iruv, which means a mixture. Exactly, a mixture. And that applies to either explanation of what the plague was in Egypt, but he's borrowing the phrase from Egypt to apply it here and to say, this book is all mixed up. That's his point. There's this mixture of passages that destroys, as he says, the entire arrangement of the book, Mirosh Adsof, beginning to end. And he's going to explain what he means. Shemilavad she'eno shomer shum seder. He says, aside from the fact that it doesn't seem to observe any order, there is an order in the sense that one speaks, then another speaks, then another speaks, and then the round repeats, kind of rinse and repeat. But he says there's no order to their words in terms of presenting one idea, and then another idea, and then another idea. Ein shoel kinyan, no one asks on point, ve'ein meishiv kahalacha, and responds on point. He's, again, borrowing phrases from elsewhere. Karo'oi liyod v'vikuach iyuni, as should happen if you're having a philosophical, insightful debate. She'ishtalshul advarim zem mizeb, advarim mesudarim v'ne'arachim, such that words would lead one from the other and to the next in an orderly fashion. Umit yachsim zela zeb beseder higyoni v'hiluch sichli, such that one speech would relate to the next in a logical way and with some kind of an intellectual progression. He says, you're not going to find that in this book. And to find that the answer will actually answer the question that was asked, and then the next question will contradict the previous answer. That's the way debate should work. So he says, it's not the way it works in this book. All the words are jumbled together. The messages are jumbled together. At times they're disjointed. At times they overlap. Chutz mizeh, and he says, by the way, aside from that, yishanev yishalish kol mitbakeach devarim shekvar amoram. Each speaker is not content to say something once, but they'll repeat it a second time, and they'll repeat it a third time. And each one enters into the boundary of the other. Each one will steal from the next some of his words and some of his opinion. And he'll contradict his own. So this is what I was trying to say, that, you know, as we start the speeches of the visitors, you have to recognize that it's going to be difficult to try to discern different views. Malbim is adamant that there are different views. Not everybody agrees with him. But his point is logical. He says, if you really wanted to say one thing, you would have one voice. The fact that you identify three separate voices suggests that you have three different views that are being expressed, and Malbim is going to spend the entire book struggling to identify the three different views. You could argue with his logic. You could argue, for example, that we pointed out that the friends are all coming from three different directions. Well, we weren't sure where exactly they were coming from, but the suggestion was that they're all coming from different places. Maybe it's just three different visitors from different places in order to show the idea that this is a widespread thing and they're coming from afar. And you could offer other answers. Nonetheless, we're going to do the best we can to follow Malbim's position here and to say that, yes, there are indeed views that we can identify as uniquely the view of Eliphaz, the view of Bildad, the view of Tzofar, although we will recognize that there's going to be an awful lot of overlap between them. So we'll do the best we can with that. Now, he alluded to... Well, first of all, before I get to what he alluded to, the first of our speakers is Eliphaz. So Eliphaz seems to be the greatest of the three who show up. He speaks first, and we're going to see much later in the book that that connotes a certain seniority. Because Elihu, the fourth visitor who's going to show up much later, is going to say, you know, I waited to speak because I'm junior to all of you. The idea is that probably Eliphaz is senior to the others. It also fits because he speaks the longest of all of them. He has the most to say. And he speaks in great poetic style. He has a lot of imagery. He has a lot of really interesting language that he brings to bear. We'll see that today. His chapters are, or his speeches are, first of all here, chapters 4 and 5 will be his first. In the second round, he will show up in chapter 15. And then in the third round, he's going to show up in chapter 22. It might be an interesting exercise to try to see the flow of just his remarks, to read those... Three, those four chapters, and I don't know what's going on behind me, but got it. Okay, well, that's good. You have something interesting to watch. The it's 4 and 5 is right here. 4 and 5 are his first round speech. Then chapter 15, and then 22. There is a definite progression in terms of what he does in the first round, what he does in the second round, and what he does in the third round. Take a look, please, at the Rambam in source number 2. Rambam, in his Mora HaNevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed, tells us what he understands to be the view of Eliphaz. He says, Da'at Eliphaz bezeha me'ora, hu gam kein achat min hadeot hane'amarot b'hashkacha. Remember that, per the Rambam, as well as Ralbag, this whole book is really a book about divine supervision of the events that happen in this world and different philosophies about God's attention to the affairs of this world. So he says the view of Eliphaz is one of the views that are stated classically regarding Hashem's supervision of this world. V'zeshu amar shekol ma shechal b'Iyov haya cholo al tzad hadin. He says Eliphaz believes that everything that happens to Job is fundamentally just. It is a function of justice. Ki ayu lo chata'im haya ra'oi biglalam lamet shechal bo. He must have some sins, and the sins have caused that which has happened to him. And v'hu amro l'Iyov, he says, I'll give you an example. He says, Eliphaz is going to say to Iyov, Halo ra'atcha rabah ve'ein keitz la'avonotecha. Your evil is great. Your wickedness is great. There is no end to your sins, he's going to say very sympathetically to his suffering friend. Achar כן התחיל לומר לאיוב שזה שאתה חושב אותו ונשען עליו מיושר פעולות הלכת בדרכים המעולים. He says after that he begins to say, Eliphaz begins to say to Job, that which you think and that on which you depend, that you've done great deeds and you've walked elevated paths, Eino inyan mechayev shetiya shalei meitzel Hashem ad shalo te'anesh. He says that doesn't mandate that you should be considered perfect such that you wouldn't be punished. In other words, a person might do a lot of good things. That doesn't mean they're perfect. If they've done something wrong, they're still going to get punished for whatever they did wrong. So if you have somebody who is horrible to his parents, but he gives a lot of tzedakah, one doesn't cancel out the other. He'll get rewarded for the tzedakah, but he's going to get zapped for what he does to his parents. That's what he's saying here. Eliphaz will say to Eov, you may have a good track record in certain areas, but that doesn't mean that you are perfect with God such that you shouldn't get punished. And then he continues with a verse that we will see in this chapter. The pasuk says, God doesn't have faith in, he doesn't trust his servants, meaning even the angels are not considered perfect. As we'll see. Yes.
How does he explain that? I mean, or maybe it's not relevant. People who haven't sinned yet, the innocent children who are born with disabilities, mental, physical, whatever.
Right.
I mean, if Eliphaz is saying, whoever's written this is saying, that God, that you have sinned, well, a newborn is not sinned.
Right.
So there is no...
Right, so a couple of points. Number one, we'll have to see whether Eliphaz is going to address that. Short answer is no. Second is that the author of the book is not taking sides in terms of agreeing with Eliphaz, just the opposite, as we'll see. He's going to criticize Eliphaz heavily. Remember, just like we talked about last week when we presented that view towards the end, that what Job is trying to do in chapter 3 when he curses the day he was born and asserts himself that way, is he's trying to regain control of an existence that has spun out of control. And we suggested that the author is presenting Eov doing this in order to ridicule that. In order to say, human beings try to assert control over the universe and it's pathetic and it doesn't work. So here, Eliphaz is presenting a view that in fact is going to get criticized and made fun of within the context of the book. So the author isn't agreeing. Rambam certainly is not agreeing. He's just saying, I see it in the words. But no, in short, Eliphaz is not going to address the flaws in his argument. His argument tends to be presented without a whole lot of nuance. Yes, Yvette.
How, if somebody gives tzedakah from ill-gotten gains, how is that judged?
You're asking me, as God. We have a principle within the Torah that mitzvah haba ba'avera is not a mitzvah. A mitzvah that comes about via transgression is not a mitzvah. And I think that would certainly be true. So, continuing though, just to complete the Rambam's thought here, he says, Eliphaz never leaves this path. This is his approach in round one, it's his approach in round two, it's his approach in round three. His belief that whatever happens to a person is a function of justice. We fail to grasp our failings, our chesronot, for which we deserve whatever punishment. We don't grasp it, we don't understand it, but it's there. That's the position that Eliphaz takes. Now the Rambam did something funny in this, because his first verse that he quoted is from what chapter?
22,
correct. His second verse that he quoted is chapter 4. He's gone from round 3 back to round 1. And he said, he quoted the verse in round 3, and then he said, and then Eliphaz began to tell Job, but then he quoted you a verse from chapter 4. I'm not clear on why he did this, because in fact what he has done is inverted a very important sequence within what Eliphaz does, which is to say, Eliphaz is going to evolve, not in terms of his philosophy of the universe, but in what he says regarding Eov. In his first round, as we're going to see here, he basically says, Job, you're a good man. You're a good man. You suffered. You're seeing terrible things happening to you, and that's made you angry. Anger is foolish. Turn to God, and God will take care of you. But he's very gentle, by and large. I say by and large. He's very gentle with Eob in the first round. In the second round, he's more indignant at the way Job speaks of God. And in the third round, he's going to say what Rambam quoted here, I know you've sinned, and he's going to accuse him of terrible things. Kind of remarkably, actually, I remember the first time I went through this book in a serious way, and you hit chapter 22, and suddenly you see these accusations, which have not appeared at all before then, of Job doing terrible things. And you wonder, where in the world is he getting this from? And we'll have to ask that question when we get to chapter 22 sometime next decade. But the idea here is either that he's expressing himself softly, but he's losing patience over the rounds. In other words, he believes from the start that Job has sinned in horrible ways. He just doesn't say it until he hits round three. Or another possibility, which we'll have to see, is that something happens in the way that Job expresses himself somewhere in round two that triggers Eliphaz and makes him actually change his view of Eov, of Job. Both of those are possibilities. We have to watch and see how the book evolves. Yes, Rita?
When I was reading the book, Eliphaz is telling Job over and over, he notices how evil people are punished. I miss it, like, you know,
he... Yeah, he does. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And when I was reading that, I thought that's not the problem.
Okay. Yeah.
A lot of evil people...
You are not meant to side with Eliphaz. Keep that in mind. This is very important. You are not meant to side with him.
That's another issue there. What he's saying, that all the people get... That doesn't always happen.
Well, we have to ask Eliphaz, but he's not answering. So, keeping this in mind, let's start taking a look at what happens here. We're going to be looking at chapters 4 and 5. We will not finish 4 and 5 today. It's going to overlap into next week. There's no two ways around it. But it's a very interesting, very poetic set of chapters. You find several of the verses here that make it into our liturgy. For example, if you jump quickly, if you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh, you want to be on page 1627, 1626. Take a look at chapter 5, sentence 16.
What's
the
Job?
In Job, yep. 1626, if you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh, chapter 5, sentence 16. Look at the last three words and tell me where they come from. Well, not where they come from. They come from here. Tell me where they go. Yeah. The last three words in sentence 16, what does it remind you of? No, the Hebrew. You got to do the Hebrew. Forget the English. It won't help you. The last three words... Ve'olasa kafsa piha. Piha patcha, that would be different. Ve'olasa kafsa piha is found in V'chein ten pachtecha, that's in the services of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The Ve'olasa tikbats piha is the phrase as it appears there. It's a wish that in the future evil will close its mouth. So that's one. Another one, if you take a look at sentence 24, chapter 5, sentence 24, is a classic blessing. I think it's actually the blessing given to kids before Yom Kippur. The ufakadeta navecha velo secheta, the end of sentence 24, as I recall, is in there. I think also there are a couple of other verses that I feel like they're somewhere and I can't remember where. Chapter 4, sentence 18. Chapter 5, sentence 9. But in any case, the themes that we're going to see here, the themes that we're going to see here in Eliphaz's remarks in chapter 4 and 5 are basically indirect rebuke. He will, for the most part, not turn on Job directly. Depends a little bit on how you take one verse, chapter 4, sentence 6. But generally speaking, he does not turn against Job. And his content is to say, God is wonderful and powerful. Human beings are frail and sinful. Turn to God and you'll be better off. Now, In case I wasn't clear enough when I said that you are not supposed to agree with Eliphaz, I will bring you the Talmud, which does not agree with Eliphaz. If you take a look at source number 3, this is an important passage. It's describing the mitzvah, really the prohibition, of ona'at devarim. Ona'at devarim. Ona'at devarim is verbal abuse. Okay? Taking advantage of somebody or harming somebody with one's speech. And it quotes you a biblical verse, "V'lo sonu ish es am yiso." One shall not abuse his friend or shall not abuse another. "V'ona'at devarim." This is talking about verbal abuse. "Haketzad." And it asks, can you give me an example? What qualifies as ona'at devarim? "Imhaya bal tshuva." If the person you're speaking to had repented from some wrong, "Ali omar lo zechor ma'asecha rishonim." Don't say to the person, "Remember what you used to do." "Imhaya ben gerim." If he's a descendant of people who converted to Judaism, "Ali omar lo zechor ma'asei avosecha." Don't say, "Hey, remember what your ancestors used to do." "Imhaya ger." If he himself had converted to Judaism, "Uba lilmo Torah," and he wants to now study Torah, "Ali omar lo," you can't say to him, "Peshach al nevelos utrepos shkatzim uramasim balilmo Torah shenemar epia gevura," to say, "This mouth that ate all manner of non-kosher things is now going to learn Torah." The person who's saying this might actually think that they're complimenting the person and saying, "Isn't it wonderful how you were here and now you're doing this?" But he says, "Come on, that's tone deaf. That's not, you can't do that to people." And then we get to the part that's relevant for Eo, for Job. "Imhayu yisurin ba'in alav." If a person is suffering, "Imhayu chalaim ba'in alav." If a person has disease, "Oshayim ekaber es banav," or "Rachmano litzlan," he loses his children. "Al yomar lo kederach she'amru lo chaverav le'iyov." Don't say what Job's friend said to him. "Halo yirascha kislasecha tikvascha v'tom drachecha zechorna mihu naki avad." That's what's coming up right in this chapter. Your reverence is your confidence or your foolishness. I'm deliberately not translating that yet. That's chapter 4, sentence 6, and it admits of multiple translations. But the key part is the end of the sentence. "Remember who is innocent and is destroyed." In other words, if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. And what the Talmud says is what Eliphaz is doing is verbal abuse. You do not walk into a shiva house or, you know, enter into a conversation with somebody and say, "Well, gee, something must have caused this." And as obvious as this is, you wouldn't believe the things people say.
This is what often happens when something terrible happens to you. You think it must be me, or it must be the sins of the fathers.
You know, it's legitimate in my mind for someone to say regarding himself, "Have I done something wrong? Is there something I'm supposed to learn?" But God forbid to say it to somebody else. You know, and that's really what's so offensive about what Eliphaz does and what the Talmud is picking up on.
It's insulting.
Yeah. I mean, insulting, hurtful, and so on. Okay. If you flip your page over to source number 4, that's an outline of the speech. The truth is that I first had a different outline which was longer and kind of more detailed, but then I realized I wasn't going to fit it all on one page, so I condensed it to 3 themes. The first part, he's going to say suffering happens for a reason. The second part, he's going to say man is no competition for God. You can't outrighteous God. If God did this to you, and his assumption is that whatever happens, God has done to you, then it must be that you've done something wrong. And his suggestion in chapter 5 is, so stay with God. And then he has a concluding line at the end. That's the basic outline. There's more to it, as we'll see. But what I would like to focus on as we go through this, keep 2 questions in mind, please. Question number 1 is, what is Eliphaz trying to accomplish? What does he want to do here? Is he rebuking? Is he giving hope? Like, what exactly does he want to accomplish with this speech? What does he want to have happen at the end of chapter 5 that didn't exist in the beginning of chapter 4? That's one question. A second question is, as you hear him speak to Job, how do you see Job responding? Like, try to imagine Job's mental state as these things are being said to him, knowing what we know about him. This is now our ninth week of looking at Job, so we have some sense, at least based on what we've read, of what he's experienced and how he has responded until now. Try to think about where this is all going. And now let's dive into the text itself. Perek Dalet, chapter 4, Pasuk Aleph, sentence 1. If you're using the Sefer Tanakh, it is page 1624. He begins, well, we begin, Vayan Eliphaz HaTemani Vayomar. Eliphaz declared, remember, Vayan is not to respond, Vayan is to declare. Maybe that's the problem with this book. There's a lot of declaring, there isn't so much responding. That may be part of the problem that Malbim was pointing out. But Eliphaz declared and he said the following. And now we're going to read sentences 2 through 6 as a unit, because they are a unit. This is his request for permission to speak. Hanisa davar elacha til'eh, va'atsor b'milin mi yuchal. I'm going to translate this one way. There are other ways you could translate it, so let's see how it goes. But, Hanisa davar elacha til'eh, if I were, and I see that this is not the way Art Scroll translates it, I'll explain why in a minute, but if I were, or if someone were, to attempt to speak to you, would you be worn out by it? Okay? If someone were to speak to you, would you be worn out? Va'atsor b'milin miyuchal. But who can refrain from speaking? What choice do I have? Even if you're going to say, yeah, I really don't want to hear what you have to say, I have to speak. I feel compelled to speak. Because, hine yisarta rabim, because you rebuked many people, Eov. I know you. We go back a ways. And I remember that when people suffered, you rebuked them. V'yadayim rafo techazek, and you strengthened weak hands. When people were weak, you gave them chizuk. You strengthened them and said, come on, have courage. Koshel yikimun milecha. When people stumbled, your words picked them up. Uvirkayim korot ta'ameitz. When knees buckled, you strengthened them. Ki ata tavo elecha vatele. Now this is going to happen to you, and you're going to be worn out by it. Tiga adecha vatibahel. It's going to touch you, and you are going to be thrown off. You're going to be confused. You, when everybody else was suffering, you were more than happy to offer them advice and you strengthened them. And now it's happening to you. So I'm going to return the favor. And I'm going to give you my version of chizuk. I'm going to strengthen you. And then the all-important sentence 6, which is very hard to render. Halo yir'ascha kislasecha. I will translate it the way the majority of authorities and translators do, which is to read it as, your reverence for God is your strength. It's that in which you trust. Your hope, the tmimut, the completeness of your path. Job, you've been a wonderful person all these years. You strengthened other people. So now let me speak to you and let your faith carry you. That is a way to read this this unit here. Going back to the beginning of it. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, isn't kislatecha ksil?
Hang on, I'm coming back. I'm coming to that. It's a good question. Hold the thought. I want to go back to sentence 2 first. When he says hanisa devar elecha til'eh, which I translated as, if someone were to say something to you, would you be exhausted by it? So you could translate it the way the Art Scroll does here, and some do, which is to say, if something were to happen to you, something bad like what has happened, would it exhaust you? Meaning he's saying, I can't believe that you're going to be exhausted by this. The reason why I chose the other approach of, if someone spoke to you, would it exhaust you, is because this whole thing is his, apologetic request for permission to speak. So it makes sense that that would fit. The other way also fits well with sentence 5, which says, if something happens to you, will it exhaust you? So there are reasonable arguments for both translations. But his major point, and that's what I said in the beginning of the year, that we're not going to go word by word by word, because we'll never, ever, ever finish this book then. His major point here is, he is asking permission to speak. He says, I can't hold back, even though I know things are terrible for you right now. But look, you strengthened other people, now I would like to strengthen you. Now, in sentence 6, Diana points out that the word used that I translated as your source of confidence, your strength, is the word also for ksil, a fool. So another legitimate way to translate this line, and Rashi does this, is that it's actually an attack on Eel. It's an attack on Job. And the way that he takes it is, you were so God-fearing all along. And when bad things happen to people, you told them that they should just trust in God and everything's going to be okay. Now, you turn around and curse the day you were born. Or try to tear down heaven and earth, or all the different approaches that we gave to that chapter last week. How dare you? It turns out that all of that fear of God was just foolishness. That's the alternative way, and that's Rashi's way to take this sentence. The word kesel, the root kaf samach lamed, is an interesting word. It can mean bitachon, faith, and the reason to go with that translation is because we will find this word appear twice more within the book of Eov, and in the other two, it's very clearly a function of faith. You'll see it again in chapter 8, sentence 14, and in chapter 31, sentence 24. And that's why I favor that that translation. The Olam HaTanach commentary here notes that the word kesel in ancient Near Eastern languages can refer to a muscle. And that it becomes a term then for something that you trust and something that is a source of strength. But yes, Rashi's view is that this is actually open rebuke, unlike the gentle tone that we anticipated for him. There's one other approach to that verse. If you take a look at source number 5, look at Mitzudat David. He takes it as a rebuke, but he takes kesel also as a term for that which you believe in. But look what he does in source number 5. He says, "Halo ata nira lemafreya." And now it appears, in retrospect, "Shekol yiratcha ita leman bitchoncha ba." He says, you know why you had reverence for God? It was because you trusted that as a function of your reverence, then la sigma vukashcha al yadeha, you would acquire whatever it was that you wanted, whatever it was that you sought. You trusted in your reverence to buy you things. He's supporting the view of the Satan about why people do good things. He's saying, yeah, you revered God, but it was just because you felt that was the way to get what you wanted. It was not from a complete mind, from reverence for God's greatness. You weren't a real believer. So that's another approach. But again, to sum up what we've seen in this section, because I don't want people to lose the big picture as we look at a specific verse, he begins hesitantly, but insistently. He's hesitant over the fact that he doesn't know if Job is going to accept what he has to say, and that's going to color his tone throughout these two chapters. But he feels like he's obligated to speak. He must respond to what Job has been saying. Questions about these verses that we just read? No? We're good? Okay. Then let's get into what he actually has to say. Watch this. Our next section here is verses 7 to 11, in which he will outline his view of just who suffers. And this, sentence 7, is the one that so upset the Talmud we saw before. Zichor na mihu naki avad. Remember now, who is innocent and destroyed? Ve'efo yisharim nichadu. Where do we see that righteous people are wiped out? Doesn't happen. Kasher ra'isi chorshei oven vizorei amal yiktziru. You know, I'm going to read this straight through because there's so much here to comment on, but we have to read it straight through first, and then we're going to come back verse by verse. There's beauty in this. Kasher ra'isi chorshei oven. As I saw people who plot wickedness, v'zorei amal yiktziruhu, those who plant struggle. Amal is a word not just for struggle, but for vain and empty struggle. It's a bad term. It's not struggle like when you're exercising to accomplish something. This is struggle in a bad way. Those who plant amal yiktziruhu, that's what they harvest. An idea we find in various prophets, variations on this on this image. Minishmat elokayovedu, verse 9. Nishmat does not mean soul of, it's nishima, breath. From the breath of God, they are destroyed. They, meaning the wicked people who plan sin and so on. Umeruach apo yichlu, from the breath of God's nostrils or God's rage, depending on how you translate that, yichlu, they will be destroyed. Shagat aryeh, v'kol shachal, v'shinei kfirim nita'u, the roar of the lion, the voice of the young lion. The teeth of the young lions, nita'u, are broken or disappear. Different translations available for that word. Last sentence in this section, layish oved mibli taref. A layish is another word for a lion of some kind or another. An old lion? You think so? Okay. It sounds good to me. The old lion is destroyed, mibli taref, without any prey. Ubnei Lavi yitparadu, and the sons of the lioness yitparadu, which is a term for destruction as well, like yitparadu kopole aven in Tehillim. What is the theme here? What is the theme?
You deserved it.
You deserved it. Why do you say that?
Well, because of the first.
Right. He says anybody who's destroyed must be bad. Okay. Maybe. What else do you see? There's so much here. Eliphaz loves his images. Before we got to the lion, if you take a look quickly at Chet, Yvette, I'll come back to you in a minute. But take a look at sentence 8. The planting image. Chorshe aven zorei amal yiktziruhu. To be choresh is to... What? To plow. Yeah, exactly. Choresh can mean plowing and it can mean plotting. Exactly. So he uses the image of people who plow, people who plant, and then people who harvest. It's this progression. Sorry?
ISIS.
What do you mean?
ISIS.
Because?
Wow.
I am... I'm focusing on the language, but you're right. But we've seen this in this book before. It's not unique to Eliphaz, this progression of language. Like Job went last chapter, he talked about the beginning of the night, and then the middle of the night, and then the end of the night in a verse, right? He did it also with... He talked about being in the womb, and then labor, and then birth, and then nursing, right? So he has these progressions. So that's another one here. He has plowing, planting, harvesting. And then you have, of course, the big one in 10:11 that Rebecca pointed out, 5 different terms for lions, right? Aryeh, Shachal, Kfir, Layish, and Lavi. So it may be that we can actually identify, you know, different stages or genders for the different lions, but that's not the point. The point is the poetry of it. This is the way Eliphaz speaks. He has this very poetic style.
And you left, I mean, even the way he describes the grief, like the grief in Ishmael the Ruach, even that is like,
yes.
You don't have to use that. You could have said it in a very simple way.
Right. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Nishima and Ruach fit this as well. The who is the lion that he's talking about in 10:11? Maybe. But I think he's talking about in general. I don't think he's talking about Eov, certainly not directly, because he's really not, other than however I take sentence 6, he's really not going to be direct in any criticism of Eov. So I look at it more as a description of people who are bad. He's using the lion as a negative image. You bet that was what you were going to say before? Okay. The lion is the wicked person who harms and bullies others and is now harmed in response. Sorry?
Cannot find prey.
Right, he cannot find prey. If you take a look at sentence 7, there are two key things here that you shouldn't miss. He begins, zicharna, remember. What is he suggesting by doing that? What is he suggesting by saying remember?
Pointing to something in Job's experience.
Job's experience? In Job's knowledge. He's like, I'm not telling you anything new. You already know this. Remember, get a grip on yourself and remember what you yourself believe. Because I know you, and I know that you believe that, in fact, if bad things happen, it's a function of having been bad, having done something wrong. And the other thing that's worth catching here is that in this little section here, sentences 7 to 11, there's a word that appears three times. Not an accident. Nothing's an accident in this book. Except maybe what happens to Job, but that's another story. What word appears? Oved. Oved, Aleph Bet Dalet, not to be confused with an ayin. Aleph Bet Dalet means to be lost or to be destroyed. It tends to be a harsher word. We use the term also for loss, but it's destruction. And look at the way it's used. In sentence 7, he says, and this is Ralbag's point, and it's a very important point in Ralbag's philosophical read of this argument. He says in sentence 7, remember who is innocent and is destroyed. He's not saying to Job, you must be evil. He's saying something else to Job. He's saying, if people are good, they won't be destroyed. They may suffer, but they will not be destroyed. Who will be destroyed? Sentence 9. The wicked who are blown away by the divine breath in sentence 9, or in sentence 11, Laish Oved. The lion is going to be obeyed. The wicked person is going to be destroyed. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 6, where I brought it to you from Ralbag. This comes from his summary of the chapter at the end of the chapter, rather than on the verse itself. He says, Hanikiyim v'hayisharim, those who are innocent, those who are righteous. If it happens that some bad events reach them, those events do not destroy them entirely. As happens with the bad things that befall wicked people. And this is meant as a sign for you. This is meant to teach you something, Eov. She'elu ara'ot einam noflot b'mikre, that those bad things don't happen by chance, k'mo she'ata meniach, as you, Job, assume, because remember, Ralbag believes that Job is saying that the constellations run the universe, and that he's cursing the night of his birth, because that the night of his conception, because that predicted when he would be born, and under which star, and therefore what would happen to him in life. So he says, no, that's not the way life works. If that were true, if it was all chance, then everybody would meet the same fate. Whether good or bad, they would suffer the same way. And Eliphaz says it's not true. The good people survive. Only the bad people, he says, are fully destroyed. Now, we look at it and say, who are you kidding? But that's what he's saying. That's the philosophy that he's presenting, and therefore, and this is why I'm emphasizing this, what he's saying is, Eov, you're a good guy, because you're still here. You haven't been destroyed. Now, what this says about Eov's kids, right, who have been destroyed, he's not addressing. Eliphaz addresses the points that are of interest to him in presenting this point of view. He's not dealing with the question that was asked before about the small children. That's not his focus. The idea is, so Job, you're good because you're still around. Yes, Rita.
Is there another way of looking at this, saying to Job that he is not going to be destroyed? He, who he is, will stay with us. And the wicked people, they just become so corrupt. It doesn't matter.
Interesting. So I would say two things. One, You began by asking, you know, is there another way to read this? Oh boy, is there ever. There are layers upon layers and books upon books and academic papers upon academic papers that you can read, and each one, you know, adds another layer and another perspective. And I'm filtering from what I've read on this in order to try to present something that's somewhat coherent. But yes, there are always more ways. In terms of looking at this in terms of the downfall, not a downfall in terms of his end of his existence, but downfall in terms of his moral deterioration. I think it's an interesting idea. You'd have to track how that plays out in the rest of his speech and see. But it's certainly an interesting idea. Okay. So what we've seen is, number one, his apologetic introduction where he says, do you mind if I say something? Because I'm gonna. And then his second part, in which he says, wicked people suffer, and as Ralbag reads it, wicked people are destroyed. And Job, you're not one of those. Job, you're a good guy. And then he says something which is a hallmark of Eliphaz in this book. I think I mentioned in the introduction to the book in general that each one credits a different authority. Each of the speakers credits a different authority for his point of view, where he got his ideas. Eliphaz's hallmark here and in the second round is to say, I am actually presenting a vision from God. I didn't make this up. This comes from God. So keep that in mind as you read the next section, which is going to be sentences 12 to 16. Hopefully we will get through this and count it as a good day. He says, Ve'elai davar yigunav. He says, to me a word stole. To me a word stole. As in, I heard something I wasn't worthy of. I was somehow privy to something that was, you know, overheard, eavesdropped. Vatikachlasni shemetz menhu. And my ear took something from it. Shemetz suggests it's an element of it. I heard something and I only comprehended a little bit of it. Again, this humility that he uses to express himself. That's going to be gone eventually, but it's here now. Bisi'ipim mechezionot laila. In Si'ipim, Si'ipim, the Dan Mikra edition renders as Hirhurim, thoughts. What does the art scroll do with it? It's thoughts. Okay. When thoughts mechezionot laila, from the visions of the night, binfol tardema al anashim, when people fall into tardema. Tardema, a deep sleep. I want to come back to that word in a minute. Pachad kira'ani ur'ada. Fear befell me, and ra'ada, trembling, verov atzmosai hifchid, it intimidated most of, or the great number of, my bones. And notice once again, he uses different words, pachad, ra'ada, and he's going to use another one now, veruach al panaya chalof, a wind blew over my face, tesamer saharat bisari, it made my hair stand up on end. You thought that was just a common phrase. That's Tanakh.
Wind and breath is a recurring motif as well.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Quite a bit in this. And throughout the book and throughout the speakers. That's not just Eliphaz. That's something we'll see a lot of. Yamod v'lo akir mar'ehu t'muna l'neged einai. It. I don't know what it is. It stood. I could not tell what it looked like. I couldn't make it out. Tzmuna l'neged einai, an image before my eyes. Dimamava kol eshma. That's an interesting.
Ma is also a motif in this book too.
Yes, and a particularly fitting one in terms of Dom being silence and Bayidom Maharon and so on. But he says dimama v'kol eshma. Dimama is silence. I heard silence and a voice. You think back to Eliyahu, right? At Chorev, kol demama daka, the still small voice. You got it. Well, there's no demama. There's just a kol. It's that contrast that I find so fascinating. I heard silence and a voice. Ha'enosh, and then he begins his speech. But actually, we're gonna pause with that. This is his description, his introduction of the vision that he saw. He saw something that stole to him. what does that mean? So if you take a look at source number 7, Rashi says, Ve'al ado odotecha, regarding you, a light divar nivua yigunav, a prophetic message stole to me, kedavar ganuv, like something stolen, lefi shein ruach hakodesh nigla al nivieh ovdei kochavim befarhesia, because divine inspiration is not revealed publicly to the prophets of the idolaters. What is he talking about? It's source number 8, which I'm going to explain outside rather than read inside in the interest of time. But it's a Moshe after the golden calf. When God says to Moshe, fine, I'll spare the Jews, but I will not travel with them. I will not be manifest upon them. I'm going. And Moshe says to God, don't you dare. He says, you're staying with us. And he says, v'niflinu ani v'amcha, I and your nation need to be marked as different from everybody by having you with us. And so on that, the Talmud comments in source number 8, saying that Moshe requested 3 things, and one of them was that God only be manifest among our prophets and not the prophets of the nations of the world. We should be marked as a part that God is with us. And that's what Rashi is reading in here. But along the way, he's endorsing the idea that the characters in this book are not Jewish. Because otherwise that would make no sense. The Rashi's comment clearly assumes that in fact Eliphaz is not a Jew. So he says, this vision was stolen to me. I only got a piece of it. It came at a time of dreams, and he uses that magic term, Tardema. Tardema is a term we find in Bereshit when Hashem puts Adam to sleep, right? And separates Chava from Adam. We find it also with Abraham at the Brit Bein Abitarim, the covenant that God makes with Abraham. It's a word that we associate with an encounter with God. But on the other hand, it's also used in Yeshaya, Perek Chaf Tet Pasuk Yud, Yeshaya 29:10, we don't have time to look it up right now, as a term for obfuscation, for making things obscure. So Tardema is open to interpretation. He could be saying I was privy to a vision, or he could be saying things were extremely unclear to me. The word Tardema could actually be rendered either way. Elihu is going to use the term also later on in the book. But he says, I was afraid. I wasn't worthy of this vision that I saw. I lacked comprehension. It was a low voice. Silent, barely audible. I have something special to tell you, Eov. What I have to tell you was so frightening and so beyond me. But there's something special that I want to tell you. And that's what's going to come next, is going to be his major vision that he wants to give him, which you're going to have to wait a week for. For which I apologize. I had said weeks ago that I was really hoping to do this in a year. And the more I see of it, the more I think ain't happening. There's just too much to do. But I'm trying, and I said this in the beginning, I'm trying to modulate between presenting everything on a pasuk and presenting that which will give us some kind of a coherent understanding of the book. And hopefully we'll... Yeah, well, except that people who signed up thinking they were getting Job in a year, I feel bad. But that's... That's one approach. Yeah. We'll see. We're going to do the best we can with it. But now, also, Rebecca is here, so we can answer the